the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's the 4th of March. Fires, floods, hail, storms, mini tornadoes. We've had it all in Victoria already this year, but are farmers falling through the cracks when it comes to disaster relief?
That's just quite absurd to say if 30 farmers suffer 50 or 100 grand's damage to their property, they get nothing. But if 3,000 farmers or 300 farmers get the same sort of damage, then suddenly the taxpayer comes in to help. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It certainly doesn't seem fair.
Also today, there are concerns a major medicinal cannabis producer is running out of money, and the wheat price fell severely on the weekend, pretty severely. What's going on? We're going to find out exactly what is going on together.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's talk disaster relief, though, to start, though. With farmers who suffered damage in summer storms and extreme weather say they're still waiting for many of those events to be recognised as disasters so they can actually access funding for help. 28 local governments from the Mitchell Shire to the Gunnawarra Shire that were affected by floods in December and January can now share in a $21 million response fund. That money comes through a joint federal-state-funded disaster recovery funding arrangement and was announced on the 25th of February. But farmers and industry leaders say agriculture will miss out again on financial support, and they're calling for an overhaul of the disaster assessment process to make sure it doesn't happen again. Fiona Broome reports.
It's been a tough summer for farmers across Victoria. Fires, floods and storms have swept across the state. Some of these disasters attracted recovery funding within a couple of days. Others are yet to be declared disasters. Damien Stock runs a small beef cattle operation with his partner Angela in Gippsland. They copped repeated heavy rains over the summer.
From early December through to mid-January, we had three floods, the worst one being December 26th, which wiped out kilometres of fencing, destroyed paddocks that were reserved for fodder production, moved cows from paddock to paddock and out into the adjoining state forest because some of the fences that were destroyed were boundary fences.
Down the road, Wendy Whelan milks 410 dairy cows on about 250 hectares. She bought her farm 2 years ago and says she's now facing tens of thousands of dollars in flood damage bills.
On Boxing Day, I think we had 150 mils in about 8 hours. I've had a lot of my tracks just had the fines taken off them, so they'll have to be resurfaced. And rough estimate have been quoted around the $40,000 to $50,000 mark, because we have quite a lot of laneways for the cows to walk on.
Is any of that covered under insurance?
No, apparently you can't insure your tracks. Today I had a call from the Shire just asking what sort of damage I sustained. I did do a flood impact form and sent it to Agriculture Victoria yesterday, but I hadn't heard anything prior to that.
Is there any, as far as you're aware, is there any financial support available to you?
No, I haven't heard of any. And I did contact Danny O'Brien and he looked into it and said there wasn't anything at the moment.
Danny O'Brien is the state member for Gippsland South. He's been pushing the government for recovery funding for farmers.
Yeah, look, it doesn't seem like there's any funding for business or primary producers from the December-January floods, and that's disappointing. It highlights, I think, a failure in the system in that there's a threshold of the number of farmers that need to be impacted by a particular event, and I think that's just quite absurd to say if 30 farmers suffer 50 or 100 grand's damage to their property, they get nothing. But if 3,000 farmers or 300 farmers get the same sort of damage, then suddenly the taxpayer comes in to help. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It certainly doesn't seem fair. And I think I've actually raised this with the Minister for Emergency Services, seeking for that anomaly to be addressed.
Has any disaster recovery funding been announced for the February 13 storm that went through Merbeu North? Is there any available funding that will benefit agricultural operations?
No, not for farmers or primary producers of any sort. Yes, there are some that might be able to get the prolonged power outage payment, but that's a drop in the ocean compared to the damage that some have sustained.
Is the system fast enough to respond to disasters?
I think there's a fundamental problem here with both state and federal governments that we're just not getting action quick enough. Given the level of disasters that we've had, bushfires, floods, storms in the last 10, 15 years, you would think we'd have the process in much better shape. To have the December, January floods assistance only announced last week towards the end of February just shows how inflexible and slow the bureaucracy is to respond.
does the disaster assessment and response system need to be overhauled?
Oh, I think so. I think the fact that the criteria is excluding the sort of assistance that I'm talking about for farmers who are affected in a more localised event shows that it's not responsive enough. And look, this is not all about throwing taxpayers' money at people who go through a bad time. People obviously need to be prepared. They need to have insurance where they can. But for many of these events and damage that occurs, particularly to fences, they're just not insurable. And so I think we do need to have an overhaul of the system and also make it a lot more nimble.
The ABC asked the government whether agricultural properties were eligible for the cleanup program. In an email, an Emergency Recovery Victoria spokesperson said, "The recently announced cleanup program will provide eligible residents with access to no-cost property assessments, make safe demolition and removal of hazardous debris where necessary." But they didn't provide specific details about farms. Mr. Stock says he registered with Emergency Recovery Victoria as a flood-affected farmer, but he says after several phone calls and emails, he's none the wiser about what support he's actually eligible for.
It all seemed to be really, really intangible support. There was nothing in the call yesterday or the previous call we had with them last Thursday that actually offered any tangible assistance to us. I pay all of my insurance for both my business and my personal residence. I can't insure for flood damage for fencing, so I have all of the insurance in place, so I effectively don't appear to be able to get any financial assistance. The programs that are not necessarily government-run programs but may be partly funded by the government, they're not here to help us either.
And the Victorian Farmers Federation has launched a call for donations to its disaster relief fund. VFF Vice President Daniel Cucinotta says the disaster assessment system is failing the agricultural industry.
It's a great mystery. Unfortunately, we have very little understanding on how the government and departments decide necessarily what becomes a disaster versus what does not become a disaster and what regions get that assistance at a time. And I can speak from experience. Early last year, my region of Werribee South ended up with severe flooding of the horticulture crops around our area. And we were sending videos to the department at the particular time to say, look, we've got extreme flooding. All the crops have been decimated. They're going to have to go back into the ground. And we were told that's not the information they were getting on the ground and that can't be correct. So we were already arguing whether or not there was even a problem, let alone whether or not they could call it a disaster, whether that we could get funding. And unfortunately, farmers in my particular region at that time just simply had to clean up the mess themselves and move on. And thank goodness farmers and agricultural communities in rural and regional Victoria is so resilient. But we were arguing whether or not the flood and the storm had even happened, let alone the next part of the journey.
If something isn't recognised as having been a disaster, that means then the funding can't follow. So then what's the solution there? Does the money have to come from the community or from the businesses themselves?
Yeah, really, really hard for your insurance to cover lost crops, unfortunately. Depends on, I guess, the kind of insurance, what's happened. And I mean, insurance companies are no easier to work with in different parts of the state. On a number of occasions, it's actually the communities who pick back up. It's the communities who donate time, resourcing, they donate money. And that's essentially what the Disaster Relief Fund is. That's how we get our agricultural communities back up and running, even if it is a small grant. It's how we show resilience and it's how we help each other. Unfortunately, the government grants have a long way to go before they sustain food security in this country.
That is VFF Vice President Danielle Cucinotta ending that report from Fiona Broome. You can read more about this if this is important to you. It's up online right now at abc.net.au/rural. Let's turn away from disaster relief, though, and talk about the future of a major company that was seen as a real saviour in regional areas, a new industry, if you will. The shares in one of the largest medicinal cannabis growing businesses has been suspended since Friday due to concerns about its debts and future funding plans. Our rural reporter Elsie Kennedy joined me earlier for the details on the future of the CAN Group, which produces medicinal cannabis in northwest Victoria.
Can Group is one of Australia's biggest medicinal cannabis producers. It was the first company to be issued with a research licence for cannabis in 2017. That was just after medicinal cannabis was legalised in Australia in 2016. It's got a big glasshouse in Mildura. And on Friday, the ASX suspended the shares of Can Group. It said on Friday that that was due to a report by an independent auditor, which said there was insufficient evidence of future funding for Can Group. Now, Can Group released a financial report on Thursday, so just the day before its shares were suspended. In that report, it said that it was confident that it was a going concern, but the ASX is obviously a bit concerned about the independent auditor's assessment of that. So the status at the moment is that those shares have been suspended.
For how long will the shares be suspended, do we know?
At this stage, we don't know. I have contacted Can Group. I heard back from them this morning. They said that they're in communication with the ASX and they're not able to comment at this stage. So at the moment, what we do know is that the suspension is in relation to its ability to finance itself. Based on the financial report that the company put out on Thursday, we know that it is in a fair amount of debt. We don't know how long the suspension will go on, but it has debts of about $64 million. Last year, it reported an operating loss of $14.34 million. At this stage, it's looking for funding. The company said in its financial report that it was looking for funding or refinancing options, and it was in discussions with some parties around that. So I think it's TBC on that at this stage.
For those who don't know Can Group and their operations, where are they located and how many people are they employing?
So officially it is a secret location. It's in the outskirts of Mildura. They've got a very large glasshouse set up. It's the size of four Melbourne cricket grounds. So they've really decided to go at scale. They employ about 40 employees, from my understanding. I spoke to them a bit before Christmas. Those employees are a lot of people who've come in from horticulture. They're working with the medicinal cannabis plants, pruning them, planting them, transferring them around the facility. It's a very high-tech facility, and they've invested a huge amount of money into it, millions of dollars. At this stage, as far as we know, that's still operating.
I'd imagine that's a concern for Mildura as well. Businesses that large, that have buildings that large, that employ 40 people, are usually hard to come by in regional communities.
That's right. And this industry is largely setting up, not just Can Group, but other medicinal cannabis producers are setting up in regional Australia. We have Canatrek in Shepparton. There's ECS Botanics near Kerrang in Victoria. There are also a number of others. There are about 66 companies that have licences to cultivate medicinal cannabis. They're all in regional areas. And Can Group isn't the first one to have financial difficulty. In 2022, administrators were appointed to a Queensland medicinal cannabis cultivator called Tikkun Oceana. At the time, the administrator said that that company didn't have enough sales to cover its operating costs. In March of 2022, there was also a big partnership. It was supposed to go in at Toowoomba. It was a facility that was planned to be, there was investment worth $400 million, a partnership between Australian Natural Therapeutics Group and Canadian-owned Esterion Cannabis Inc. And that was canned before it actually started. There were some big announcements in the lead-up, but in the end, the chief executive of ANTG, Matt Cantello, said that the facility, he thought it was, in the end, just too big too soon for the Australian market. So it's a big industry. It is getting started. And yeah, it's got the potential to employ a lot of people in regional Australia. It is already employing a lot of people in regional Australia, but we have already seen some of these companies collapse.
Is there anything else we need to know, Elsie?
At this stage, I think it's just a bit of a wait and see what happens here. We know that Can Group, look, before they released their financial report, they did also tell the share market that they were in a legal situation. There's a New Zealand company which is taking them to court. That was announced on the 16th of February. We also know that they've gone to shareholders a couple of times in the past for funding increases to expand their Mildura facility. We know that they need money at this point. Yeah, it's just a wait and see.
That is rural reporter Elsie Kennedy telling you where things are up to with the Cairn Group, major employer in the Mildura region, 40 or so workers, and in a trading halt on the ASX. When we know more, we'll let you know. As always, you can read more online at abc.net.au/rural. Let's talk about your ability to repair your machinery right now. I feel like we've had this conversation a lot and things haven't changed. Guess what? More than 18 months after the right to repair legislation passed for the motoring industry, it has still not been extended to farm machinery. And an expert researcher says that's not good enough. Since July 1, 2022, car manufacturers have been required by law to share service and repair information with independent repairers. But there is no such requirement when it comes to farm machinery. That means farmers and their independent mechanics are locked out of repairing machines. So when breakdowns happen, machines must be repaired by the manufacturer or authorised repairer. Professor Leanne Wiseman, chair of the Australian Repair Network at Griffith University, says despite federal authorities highlighting the need for farmers to have the right to repair, it still hasn't happened.
Some of the challenges that we're seeing with repairing ag machinery has really been identified by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and the Productivity Commission, is that there's really serious competition concerns in the agricultural machinery aftermarket in Australia. And why this is that really our farmers can't get access to the information, spare parts and tools that they need to fix their tractors when they break down. They're really forced to go back to authorised repairers of the manufacturers. But a lot of these farmers are diesel mechanics. They've got the skills and knowledge. They've always been tinkering with their tractors. And it's just that these tractors are now software enabled that they really don't have access to that software, and that's really what the barrier to repair is for ag machinery.
And you must hear a lot of frustration over that when, as you've said, a lot of the time farmers have got the skills to do the repair work, they've paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for these machines, and they can't repair what can often be pretty minor issues with them.
That's exactly right. So what we're seeing and we're hearing from farmers all around the country is the fact that they've always been able to change a sensor or a filter or whatever it might be on their tractors. But now, because they're so sophisticated with the software that's embedded in them, if they try to do anything with their tractors, they potentially either will breach their warranty or basically the machine will be bricked. It won't work if they try to tamper with the software. So this is really causing such a challenge for them. The industry is no different to, for example, the automotive industry, and we've just seen Australia's first right to repair law being passed last year, because our independent mechanics were in that same position. They could not get access to the information that they needed and the diagnostic software that they need to fix our cars. And everybody always thought that they'd have to take their cars back to the dealer or the authorised manufacturer to get those warranty or service and repairs. But it's recognised it creates such a competition issue to deny independent repairers that information. And with our farmers, as you say, their diesel mechanics, their fitters and turners, they're all really high skilled, and they've been doing this for decades. They should really be able to fix their tractors.
Is there any reason why that legislation around right to repair in the automotive industry can't be extended to farm machinery?
No, that's a very good point, and that's exactly what the ACCC and our Productivity Commission has said, both in their inquiry reports in 2021. We have a scheme. It's governed by the ACCC. It's got teeth. It's working for automotive repair. We just know that agricultural machinery and heavy vehicles have been excluded from that scheme from its introduction. But it's already been indicated that there may be that scheme should be revisited to include agricultural machinery. And we're not seeing any movement from the equipment manufacturers to be more open and transparent with their repair and diagnostic information. They have the opportunity to share this information with farmers and independent repairers, and that's actually not happening. So if it's a case that we need to regulate, we've really got all the recommendations sitting there, and we have a scheme that will work for agricultural machinery.
So is what's required political pressure then, organisations like the Victorian Farmers Federation, to be pressuring the federal government to extend this right to repair legislation to farm machinery?
Yes, look, even speaking here today at the VFF Grains conference about the right to repair ag machinery is a really important step. We know that both Fiona Simpson, the former president of the NFF, and now David, current president of the NFF, that the NFF has a policy to support a right to repair for agricultural machinery. So we really need, and we hear it from the farmers all the time, we really need that political will to take that up to the federal government and for the government to respond by including ag machinery into that mandatory scheme.
The answer to this might be obvious, but why don't manufacturers grant right to repair to farmers?
Well, the manufacturers use a number of arguments. They say it might impact on their intellectual property over the machinery. Arguments around safety and security are raised. Certainly, we know that there is a very valuable repair and service aftermarket, and there's a lot of money being generated by restricting competition in that market. So a lot of the repairs that we're speaking about, and we've seen this issue addressed throughout the world, is that a lot of the repairs that we're talking about that farmers should be able to do are not infringing any IP rights or safety or security of those vehicles or machinery. Therefore, those arguments really aren't valid in that it's more about protecting their markets and the money that they're making in those service and repair markets.
And you talked about some good international examples of what you think should be done in Australia having already happened.
In Colorado, there's an agricultural machinery right to repair specific piece of legislation. So farmers who are denied access to what they need to fix their tractors have the ability to take that matter up with their Attorney General. There is 20... also proposed pieces of legislation around right to repair in the United States. We know in Europe that farmers do have access to the diagnostic software and the parts and tools that they need. So it's really, given Australia's geographic and climactic challenges, the distances and times that farmers have to wait for authorised repairers to access their farms, sometimes it's 2 or 3 days, it's really time for Australia to recognise that the inability of farmers to repair their tractors is really hampering the food production and ultimately food security in Australia.
And why hasn't the legislation been introduced? Is it a political reason, or is it just that people haven't got around to it?
Well, the recommendations have sat with the federal government in 2021, and then we had a change of government. And I think there's just been some time delays in recognising those priorities. But I think Australian agriculture, with its goals of reaching 100 million at the farm gate, really needs to make sure that they can keep, not only keep their farmers farming, but keep their machines moving as well.
Professor Leanne Wiseman, Chair of the Australian Repair Network at Griffith University, speaking there with Angus Verley. Rural news on the way after that. The weather, a couple of your texts first. Alan says, from East Gippsland, why should taxpayers subsidise farmers for weather events? It is one of the risks that they take in the course of their business. I bet the same farmers are against the tax reforms that are so desperately needed, says Alan in East Gippsland. And Alan, the question to you, I suppose, from that story is then, why are uninsured and other people who have their own homes damaged? Because farming is a business but also a home, right? Why are they eligible when others are being excluded? I'm not giving you an answer here. I'm just asking you the question. Would love to hear your response. 0467 842 722. And I love this from Phil in the Chuka, who sends me a photo every time he's fishing. Megan was beautiful day in my whaler. No fish yet, but who cares? Don't work too hard. The lake is looking magic at Mulwala under Phil's fishing rod with a photo attached today. Phil, if you're looking for a fishing-related story, you can check out ABC Online. The big trout is going to have to be repainted at Adaminaby because they painted it the wrong colours for the rainbow trout. In its latest repaint, the community is angry. So that big thing is getting another big repaint. Hope you can go check that one out online. Let me know what you think of the paint job. One of my favourite big things, the big trout at Adaminaby. Also love it when Fiona Broom reads rural news, and she's doing that for us today. Good afternoon, Fiona.
G'day, Woz. Making rural news today, a mango farmer says a culture of secrecy is preventing current inquiries from solving issues between supermarkets and the growers supplying Australians with fresh fruit and vegetables. Many farmers in the horticulture industry are secretly sharing their battles with the big corporations, but are revealing their fear of retaliation if they publicly speak out against the supermarkets. Dale Williams from Bowen in North Queensland says it's a situation that needs to change.
I think one of the reasons we're having trouble getting growers to come forward is that there is this fear of retribution from our big buyers, where you can be basically put on holiday from them buying your product if you appear to be criticising. And I think this is a really poor situation and needs to be dealt with.
Have you seen any of these repercussions happen to people that you know in the industry?
Oh, look, it's well known in grower land, and right through from dealing with wholesalers. I mean, I'm an older generation. I've been in the industry for over 40 years. And, yeah, plenty of verbal evidence, hearsay evidence, I guess. Too much for it to be not real.
And it sounds like there's a sense of unease regarding the future of the cattle industry in Western Australia's north after the operator of the only large-scale abattoir in the region, the Kimberley Meat Company, has gone into voluntary administration. For many Kimberley cattle producers, that meatworks near Broome is their only viable alternative market to the live export trade. Bron Christensen, the head of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association, says it's going to leave some producers in a difficult spot.
As the only processor here in the north, it's reducing the capacity, I suppose, for people to turn off cattle that possibly wouldn't be suitable for other markets. It was a really a good opportunity to have an outlet here for those cattle that wouldn't handle the transport. And as well as that, it's the cost of freight down to Perth. I think we're looking at around about, you know, anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 kilometres to our nearest abattoir now. So it's certainly going to have a dramatic effect on the industry up here.
Still on cattle, and Australian feedlots had a record number of cattle on feed last quarter, reaching nearly 1.3 million head of cattle on grain. That's according to the Australian Lot Feeders Association, which believes the industry is on the lookout for reliable grain-fed beef to export. ALFA President Barb Madden says not all states saw numbers increase, but the overall trend is good.
Saw rises in New South Wales, South Australia and Western Australia. And then on the converse, Queensland and Victoria saw very small drops in numbers. And I would suggest that's just, you know, market factors at play there. Not significant, just part of the, you know, the ups and downs of running the feedlot. What it does show to me is confidence in the market, confidence in the industry that we are, you know, we're not a seasonal, well, we are seasonal, but back in the day it used to be, oh, when there's a drought, a feedlot would fill up. And then as soon as it rained and people had grass, we'd empty out. You know, no longer is it that severe rises and fall in numbers. We're now very consistent.
And the reigning champion of the giant pumpkin competition at the Ekka, that's Queensland's ag show held in Brisbane, is looking for back-to-back wins this March. Last year, the Toowoomba School Downlands College was the first school in the competition's 147-year history to win the heaviest pumpkin title, doing so with a 202-kilogram entry. Agriculture teacher Dr. Jeff Buchanan says judging is taking place this week and competition is fierce.
I've heard that one of the open growers has broken 350 kilos this year.
Well, that's huge, isn't it?
That's big, but so the world record's over a tonne, so there's still room to improve. I reckon records will tumble this year. I suspect our best one is north of 250 kilos, although it's very hard to estimate the outside because you can't see how thin they are on the inside, and that can make a big difference. So we try and bring in as much science as we can. Why do we do it? Well, it's fun, but it's important to try and get ag students involved in the plant side of it. It's easy to make animals exciting. Plants takes a bit more, so we've used competitions like this to get them to understand and get really involved in plant nutrition, disease management, and some of the agronomy sides of agriculture.
I had a couple of mega zucchinis this summer with all the rain, but I don't reckon I cracked 5 kilos, so that's very impressive. And that's Rural News Today.
Oh, Fiona, I wish I took the giant pumpkin growing class at school. That sounds awesome. Wish that was offered at Broadford Secondary College. Maybe. Maybe it is now, I don't know, but I love the idea of it. Thanks very much for that, Rural News. Weather on the way, just a couple of texts. I thought this one was really interesting, saying, on right to repair, as a mechanic, the automotive version is still absolutely useless and needlessly restricted, and it can still cost over $10,000 for the diagnostic computer, plus a few thousand dollars a year for the software, plus the membership fee. They need to make that work before adding the ag equipment to it. That's really interesting. Thank you, mechanic, for your text in that. And Tom at Winslow says, Warwick, I'm guessing the people who like to have a dig at farmers that are listening to your program are doing so whilst they're eating their lunch. Oh, the irony, says Tom at Winslow. We'll take that as a comment. Stephanie Miles is a senior forecaster with the Bureau of Meteorology. You can join us now to take us through the weather forecast for the rest of the week. Hi, Stephanie.
How are you going, Warwick?
I'm good. You've never grown a giant pumpkin, have you?
No, I haven't, but I remember us having excess zucchinis as we were growing up, and Mum used to make the best chocolate and zucchini cake I've ever tasted.
It's been zucchini slice, zucchini curry, zucchini everything in our house the last few weeks. We don't mention the zucchini war anymore. Weather-wise, look, we've had a couple of crazy weeks, really, with weather. Well, weeks with some pretty bad days. How's it looking this week?
Yeah, I mean, this week in particular, it seems very settled across the state. We do have a couple of things coming through over the next few days, but already, like, it just does really feel quite settled and almost like each day is repeating itself. So for today, it looks like a glorious day across the state. There's not many clouds in the sky except for those places down in the southeast of Gippsland and then perhaps over the Surf Coast as well. But, you know, a couple of light afternoon sea breezes coming in and otherwise just sunshine for the rest of the day, which looks really nice. And then tomorrow in particular, our wind starts to turn northerly, so our temperatures are increasing just slightly across the state. We'll be perhaps in the high 20s, low 30s, pretty much everywhere across the state. And then by Wednesday, a little bit more cloud coming in. We do have a really light, weak trough that will be crossing the state, perhaps more so in the afternoon. But it's not really bringing any much difference to the temperatures as it moves through. It's more just a weak trough in between our two big ridges that are extending over. So some real warm temperatures once again on Wednesday. Thursday, Friday, because we'll be on the eastern flank of a high, it means that we will have some cloud in the south and some sunny patches in the north as our winds kind of remain more of those southerly trajectory. So a little bit cooler in the south, but again, those temperatures remaining in the north for Thursday and Friday. And then over the weekend, it's Saturday in particular, we do get those northerly winds once again strengthening, which increases our temperatures ahead of another change that will come in over Saturday night through the Sunday. But once again, the change isn't quite as pronounced as what we've had over the last couple of weeks. So it's not really bringing all that much rainfall or change in the temperatures. So the weekend is also quite hot, Warwick. So, yeah, look, it's really, you know, a couple of things happening here and there, but it doesn't really change our weather for the whole week, really.
Rain? Any rain on the extended forecast for us to get excited about, Stephanie?
Unfortunately, none that I can see. There could be a couple of sprinkles here or there, perhaps on the weekend, but, you know, nothing more than a mill or two, unfortunately.
And what are the winds like this week? You mentioned sort of the direction, but are we expecting them to get sort of any strength behind them at all?
No strength, actually. I think on Saturday will be our biggest chance of getting some maybe strong north to northwesterlies ahead of that change. But again, at this stage, it looks like the system that's really producing those stronger winds is kind of slipping further south of us and perhaps affecting more of Tasmania than it is Victoria. So fingers crossed on Saturday we don't get too many winds either.
Brilliant. Stephanie, thank you very much for the update. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Warwick. Enjoy your day.
Stephanie Miles there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. We really should do a seasonal check around the place soon because of the weather, and wonder if you're happy that it's dried up a little bit, if it's helped things like spraying programs and harvests and all that sort of jazz, or if you're on the lookout for rain. In fact, actually, the next couple of days, the Country Hour will be broadcasting from the High Country cattle sales, mountain calf sales. That's coming up for you on this very radio station tomorrow and Wednesday. We'll be hearing from producers. I'm sure we'll be able to ask them how they're looking. If you want to send in a text during those programs, you're more than welcome to. You know the number, 0467 842 722 to text us here on the Country Hour. So we've got that coming up for you. Country Hour on the road for the next few days, actually. I'm not heading to the calf sales because we got some great reporters going there. They're going to bring the shows over the next couple of days. Then I'm popping over to hang out with Angus at the Wimmera Machinery Field Days on Thursday, which is on this week. We'll head to the last day of that. Maybe in the studio again on Friday. Maybe I'll get a better offer. Stay tuned to the Country Hour. We'll be out and about speaking to people you want to hear from the next few days. So tune into the Country Hour then. That's the plug section of the program out of the way. Let's get back to stories right now. And we'll pick up where we left off on Friday, because we heard on Friday the Laverton Abattoir charged over its method of pig slaughter after activists released footage from inside the facility had accepted responsibility for animal welfare breaches. Australian Food Group, or AFG, was charged with two counts of breaching Victoria's Meat Industry Act last year by meat industry regulator PrimeSafe after the farm activist group The Farm Transparency Project released footage from inside the company's abattoir. AFG has accepted a diversion project program, acknowledging responsibility for the offending and agreeing to abide by set conditions. We tried to speak to AFG. They haven't responded. We've also tried to speak to PrimeSafe and they have not made anyone available to speak to us. We read a statement from them on Friday's Country Hour, but the Farm Transparency Project, which started all of this by entering these premises and filming, their spokesperson, Chris Delforce, is unhappy with this outcome. He's speaking to Emma Field about it here.
We're disappointed, but not particularly surprised. I think this is just another case of pretty severe animal cruelty, getting a slap on the wrist. PrimeSafe have said that it sends a message to slaughterhouses that they need to comply with the law, but I think it kind of sends the opposite message, that you can do some pretty horrific things and get away with it. And PrimeSafe have, I think they're kind of shirking their responsibility a bit here. They've only gone after AFG for some very specific incidents where pigs have had their testicles ripped off, for example, by the machinery, but they're doing nothing about the bigger issue, which is the use of carbon dioxide gassing in the first place, which is still in use in two other slaughterhouses in Victoria and is arguably against the law and has never been an acceptable way to kill pigs, but PrimeSafe are completely avoiding that issue.
That particular method of gassing pigs, that is allowed under the current regulations, is it not?
Well, that's what Animals Australia are taking PrimeSafe to the Supreme Court over, because there is no explicit mention, no explicit allowance for the use of carbon dioxide gas. It's not written anywhere in the regulations. So the Meat Industry Act refers to Australian Standards AS4696, which basically says that animals must be killed without unnecessary suffering. And there is a very strong argument that the use of these chambers is unnecessary suffering.
Until that case is decided, though, is it not, they're just, PrimeSafe are just applying the law. They're not, they don't set the laws, they're just the regulator. So they're just applying the laws as they see fit.
I think that they've made the decision to not tackle the issue of gassing. I think there is a very strong argument that gassing is not permitted by law, but PrimeSafe have chosen the easy way out to do, they're doing the least possible that they can, and targeting only these very specific incidents of machinery causing extreme pain and suffering, and then completely avoiding what would be a very reasonable thing for them to take on, which is the gassing.
Industry and regulators have not come up with gassing, but that is the method that they're using at the moment. They say that is the most humane way. What would be the alternative if they weren't using that?
Well, the alternatives are certainly awful too. The main alternative is electric stunning of pigs, and we've seen through our footage that there is a high risk of human error in that as well. But the vast majority of pigs in Australia are stunned with these carbon dioxide gas chambers, and that's been quietly rolled out since the early 90s, and it's never really been addressed. There's never really been any legal challenge to it until now.
Just going back to the AFG, the Laverton abattoir that your group allegedly broke into to film the footage. You did it to three different abattoirs. Have you faced any charges over the way you obtained the footage?
No, we haven't.
Do you think it's justifiable that you break into a business to do that?
Absolutely. There's simply no other way that this issue would see the light of day. The industry has been calling it humane for over 20 years because they know they're never going to show what it's like. And it's unfortunately up to people like us to risk our freedom, to risk our safety, and go in and get that footage so that consumers can know for themselves what they're paying for.
And we know there's a inquiry going on into the pig industry. Have you had any input into that, and what are you expecting out of that?
Yep, absolutely. So we've made a submission to that. We will be facing the committee in a hearing next Tuesday at 11 a.m.
That's Chris Delforce from the Farm Transparency Project. And just to reiterate, we did ask PrimeSafe to speak to us. They declined. And we've also asked for the Australian Food Group, the company that was charged in relation to that footage, but have not heard back from them. It's 12:45 here on the Country Hour. Warwick Long with you on the program today. Let's go overseas now and head to India. Colourful fabrics, embroidered materials, all things that might come to mind when you think of India's clothing. It's a region with a long history of textile production, and Australia's wool industry is hoping to build a long future with India's processes as it tries to diversify away from China. Joe Hall from Industry Body Wool Producers Australia has been at India's mega expo, Bharat Text. She says natural fibres are dwarfed by synthetic fibres in India, but strong wool market connections are starting to be developed.
Myself and some colleagues from both wool and cotton participated in a CXO roundtable, which was chaired by the Indian textile minister, who is also responsible for the free trade agreements as well. So that was a really great opportunity to put forward wool in front of a whole supply chain roundtable, which also featured man-made fibres and get to speak about the sustainability and the opportunity of Australian wool in India.
So you say that there's a large presence of the synthetic textiles producers. How significant is the disparity between the two? Are wool, fibre, natural textiles underrepresented, or is it fairly even?
Just due to the sheer size of and scale of the man-made fibre sector, I mean, yes, we are underrepresented, but it's interesting at the roundtable yesterday, we were hearing talk about sustainable synthetics, and to us, that's an oxymoron. So we are here really promoting the virtues of natural fibres, and specifically wool and cotton, and how that fits into the circular economy and how we tick all of the boxes in terms of eco-credentials, which, you know, post-pandemic, that's what customers are wanting. So we have an opportunity here to really try and promote these characteristics of wool to try and get those in front of processors, but also end users.
Why are sustainable synthetics not realistic?
Well, they're largely petroleum-based, and to me it doesn't appear to be very sustainable at all, not when you consider wool, which is, we like to think, it's the world's most sustainable fibre. It's renewable, it grows every year, and basically you need sun and water and grass to create wool. So, yeah, I think that really needs highlighting amongst the global trade, because we just don't believe that synthetic-based fibres can actually claim to be that sustainable.
What's next after this conference? Where are you heading to?
A small delegation are flying up to northern India, up to Himalaya Pradesh, to look at some sheep farms up there, because one of the components that the Australian industry is looking at under the free trade agreement that was ratified in late 2022 is the cooperative part. So India actually has as many sheep as Australia, and they are very keen to upskill their workforce in terms of shearing and classing of wool. So some colleagues and myself are heading up there to look at their current facilities and to see if there could be a knowledge transfer between Australia and India to help upskill their trade and their industry.
Oh, that's super interesting. It would be so unique to see different systems and the different geographic areas and just how, you know, climate and geography, all of that really plays into different systems.
It will be fascinating, and I'm looking forward to it immensely. In terms of the Indian sheep population, they are broad wools. They are sort of 24 micron plus. They are not competing with Australian superfine wool or even Australian wool in general. Australia produces 80% of the world's apparel market and apparel wool, and India just don't supply any. So we're happy to talk to the Indian industry to see if we can assist them, and that will work nicely towards gaining greater market access in India, hopefully.
That's Joe Hall, who's Wool Producers Australia CEO, speaking there to Fiona Broom. Let's look at commodity prices before we head to livestock markets. Wheat prices fell dramatically on the weekend, continuing a downward trend in grain that's lasted nearly half a year. But the news isn't all bad for grain growers, who are seeing the value of their barley increase with renewed access to China. Andrew Whitelaw from Episode 3 says, despite all that, it was still a tough weekend for wheat.
Yeah, we've just been coming under that sort of just general decline, basically for the last, basically since probably October really is when we started to see it really decline. And I'm sort of talking about sort of both locally and globally. You know, we've seen that Chicago, which is a good barometer for wheat prices, just been in that steady, steady decline. And then on the last session, we saw $10 come out of that market. Which is a fairly substantial fall.
So the overall trend had been down for nearly 6 months or so, but then on the weekend, a big fall. Is there a major reason behind the big fall on the weekend?
Look, it's a couple of reasons. There's never, it's generally never, like, these long slides are just, they're not normally just one reason. They're a combination of different factors. One of the major factors that we're seeing at the moment is just a huge amount of corn being produced. And so that's driven the market down. And largely we talk about wheat, we're really talking about also a corn market. The corn market has slid. Speculators in the market are betting on falls in the market. So they've been betting against corn. And also we have come off the back of a period of very high pricing. We've seen things like, you know, obviously the invasion of Russia that drove the markets higher in recent years. And then all of a sudden now we're having that market falling. So we are actually seeing things like Russia is exporting a lot of grain. Ukraine's exporting a lot of grain and it's very cheap. And so that is pulling the whole market down.
How far has the market fallen since October?
Look, since October, we're talking probably about $50, $60 on the sort of the Chicago wheat market. And so that is obviously a considerable fall.
And where are prices sitting now, roughly?
Like roughly, if we look at Geelong, if I'm just talking about ASW, you're talking about the low 300s. And if we're looking at barley, we're talking about the high 200s, which is also another interesting thing, is that our barley has actually, in the last week, gone to the highest premium against French barley since 2020, so 4 years.
Is that due to the access back into China for Australian barley?
Yeah. So as soon as we lost China, we went to a massive discount. Then as soon as we got China back, we moved back into a premium.
So that's wheat and barley. What's happening in the oilseed market? Canola, what is the market holding firm there, or is it falling like the rest of them?
It's not falling as sharply as the rest of them. Well, not for canola at least. But what we're seeing with oil seeds is definitely big supplies of soybeans around the world, decent supplies of palm, but also at the same time, we are seeing concerns about the actual demand for oil seeds. Oil seeds are largely an industrial product. You know, it's a biodiesel, biofuels, and so we are seeing sort of concerns about the global economy. And when we see concerns about the global economy, we can see things like, well, corn as well, actually, but soybeans and palm coming under a bit of pressure, especially if energy prices are falling. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing crude oil, sitting around that sort of mid-70s to $80 a barrel. And that is a concern because it is a sign of, potentially slowing global economy. But I think, canola prices, we are talking around about the $600 a ton mark. A couple of years ago, farmers would be, over the moon about $600 a ton. But we have seen those prices above, $1,000 a ton in recent years. But we've been arguing for a long time that isn't the norm. There is no such thing in commodity markets as a new norm. And those canola prices were jacked up because we had a big drought in Canada, which is the world's largest producer or exporter of canola. And an invasion of Ukraine, which was, the third largest exporter of canola. So, those were unusual events that transpired to cause that pricing to go through the roof. And we can't expect those type of prices year in, year out.
That's Andrew Whitelaw there from episode 3, speaking about grain prices and what happened on the weekend, and a little bit of long-term look as well. Speaking of prices. Market time. Let's get right into it. Bendigo Sheep and Lamb Report with Jenny Kelly. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Slight lift in supply, but a big drop of in buyer demand, particularly for sheep. Everything was cheaper except for small bag lambs, which held their value and looked to be selling well in comparison to everything else today. Heavier processing lambs over 24 kilos carcass weight were $5 to $15 down in a sale that got progressively cheaper as it went. Export lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight from $174 to a top of $224 for a big spread of $5.50 to $6.50 a kilo, depending on where they sold in the auction run, the average cost being around $5.90 to $6.10 a kilo. Good trade lambs, $130 to $159. The average price pulled back to about $5.80 to processors. But light lambs still firm at $100 to $125 for the better crossbreds with frame and $60 to $90 for decent small types. The mutton market opened $20 to $30 cheaper. By the end of the run was up to $50 down on a week ago. There were sheep down to $1 a kilo again. A lot of sheep from $10 to $60 a head, big weathers to a top of $88. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. Let's go to Wagga Cattle now and Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Due to a significant breakdown earlier today, only a fraction of the 5,300 cattle have been sold. Presently, there's a firm market for heavy cows, commanding prices between $240 and $266. Demand from domestic processors remains robust, propelling heavy steers and bullocks up 5 to 10 cents, now selling at $280 to $326. Heavy heifers, destined for processors, have seen a gain of 10 cents, fetching $285 to $312. Queensland feedlots are showing keen interest in steers weighing 400 to 500 kilos, resulting in a price jump of 14 cents for well-bred types, with prices ranging from $3 to $3.88. Lightweights are trading between $3 and $3.76. Feeder steers in the trade category are selling at $3.15 to $3.25, while trade heifers are commanding prices from $2.90 to $3. Feeder heifers are mostly steady at this point, priced at $2.55 to $3.09. With the balance of the stock yet to be sold, I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Let's go to Pakenham. G'day, Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers increased to 1,680. That's 950 more, with the usual buyers operating, not all fully, in a cheaper market in places. Quality was limited, with secondary cattle well supplied. The best trade lots sold firm, with the balance of the young cattle easing 15 to 30 cents, with quality an issue. Grown steers lost 10 cents. Bullocks held firm. Manufacturing steers eased 15 to 25 cents. Heavy beef cows sold firm, while light dairy lots slipped around 35 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 3.06 to 4.93 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Veal is sold from 242 to 392. Yearling trade steers 290 to 368. The heifer portion 255 to 360. Grown steers 285 to 318. Bullocks 258 to 320. Heavy Frisian steers 175 to 268. Crossbreds 230 to 306. Most light and medium weight cows 84 to 224. Heavyweights 185 to 255. And the heavy bulls are still to be sold. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to Mortlake Cattle and Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Warwick. With no market next week and a diminishing dry feed, numbers jumped up to 2,607 head at Mortlake. An increase of 1,200 on last week's offering was a good offering over most categories for the top end. However, quite a few cattle are starting to show the effects of the dry conditions in most sections, and more so in the trade cattle. The market was softer over most categories sold, as the cows are yet to be offered. So far, bullocks lost up to 10 to 25 cents, manufacturing steers back by 50 cents, and the good veal is cheaper by 30 to 40 cents, and trade steers and heifers back by up to 40 cents in places. This week's offering of veal is making between 272 and 314, trade steers and heifers making between 245 and 328, with the grown cattle topping at 328 cents. Manufacturing steers sold up to 210 cents. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Chris. At the Country Hour live at the Mountain Calf Sales the next 2 days. Get around it. Tune in. Get involved in the program. Fiona Broom, Emma Field up there, Faith Tabaluyan up there. I'll just be here bringing you rural news. That sounds pretty good to me. I hope you can join us on the programs for the next couple of days. Should be a ripper. It's 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon.